Football Weekly Extra.
Football Weekly Extra, have we got a podcast for you? Yes, we have. And in it, Liverpool Arsenal, one for all, and we're all for one of the greatest games ever anywhere. Boo to proper defending. Has the draw, though, scuppered Liverpool's title bid all over again? Or will Happy Harry's Hotspurs throw us a curveball in their Man U clash this weekend? Elsewhere, a shock mention for Ipswich Town alert. Roy Keane ploughs in at Tractor Boys, leaves furrowed brows. Abroad, we go Dutch with Leander Scherlakens. In Italy, the riot police are called out in Turin over the lack of rejuvenation. And who are Muck and Mick? And what have they got to do with Roma? Warning, answer may not prove anything like as entertaining as you think. There's Sid in Spain on that Madrid derby, the penalty, the Pepe horror foul, there's Post, and a look forward to the weekend, all in Football Weekly Extra. Yes, indeed. Welcome on board, everybody. Today joining us, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
You're in particularly Tiggerish mood today.
Am I?
You're full of bounce, sir.
I am, yeah.
Sean Ingle.
Hello, James. I'd just like to say thank you, because you've just given me your last Barocca. You can probably hear I'm more bunged up than a 1970s football manager, but Jimbo has kindly had me out.
with Roy Hodgson bringing that into the 21st century. I'm sorry, I've not been introduced.
The voice of Matt Scott, sorry. No. And lawyers even now are poring over that, your debut utterance into this.
Oh, really? I think he's famously mucosal, isn't he?
I thought you were talking about the other thing. Thank goodness.
Bonged up.
Goodness me, no. No. He's the most upstanding character in English football, Roy Hodgson.
Right, okay. Just as long as we're clear about that, Mr. Hodgson. Good.
I don't think we've been quite clear enough.
Right.
Because Roy Hodgson, I would feel bad if there was even the hint of a suggestion that he... But we were purely talking about his congestion.
Adenoidal difficulties, yeah.
I'm glad you've explained the joke for my benefit, because I didn't
Matt
get
Scott
that.
Out of digger. And in fact, today, you'll find that you're probably listening to today's podcast late, because Matt was quite literally digging via the medium of a telephone. Yeah. Anything interesting, juicy?
Well, if I can stand it up, it will be, yeah.
Go on, Matt. Stand it up for us now.
No.
All right, okay. You've been a busy chap, and then we'll talk about some of your things later on. James Heal says, hi, chaps. I'm not going to listen to Thursday's podcast until Sunday while I run... He says whilst, actually. Is that correct? Whilst I run... I think it's while.
Either or.
Interchangeable.
No, they're not interchangeable.
Utterly.
They are modern journalistic practice. You can...
All right, Barry, what do you think?
I would say whilst.
Whilst I run the London Marathon.
It's fine, yeah.
I'm not sure about that. If Kevin McCarr is on, can you tell him to speak up a bit, or his voice will get drowned out by the sea of pounding trainers? He's not on, but we'll bear that in mind, James. And good luck. I'm not sure where you are right now, but Roy Keane, he's returned to football as the new manager of Ipswich 4 months out of the game after his sudden disappearance at Sunderland. He takes over at Ipswich after they sacked former boss Jim Magilton because they're, stuck in the middle of the championship, basically.
Because they found their level.
Right. Okay. Now, there's money behind this club. And is Keane, who likes to spend a bit of money, is this going to work out? Is this a good move for all concerned?
An interesting one for me, because if this Marcus Evans guy is, as you say, as rich as Croesus, the 30th richest man in Great Britain, who made his fortune from the secondary ticket markets and has dabbled in arms fairs and has his companies listed in Bermuda, so he's obviously an interesting character.
Oh, because Louise Taylor, in her admirable reaction piece to this, was saying all about how this would suit. This club would suit Keane better because it was kind of more of a gentlemanly club. But Marcus Evans not necessarily fitting that.
Yeah, I don't think he's certainly not old money by any stretch of the imagination. He's not, you know, the Kobolds have famously always had a bottle of Burgundy to match their scarlet faces when they were at in the boardroom up there for people to enjoy after matches. And it was always a very convivial, as you say, gentleman's club type atmosphere there. But Marcus Evans is a bit different. But whether or not it's going to be... I mean, the thing about Marcus Evans is that he is so desperately secretive to the point of paranoia. East Anglian Daily Times have a photograph of him that I understand they... put the newspaper under a great deal of pressure not to publish that photograph of him. There is one in circulation.
Was it really bad with him coming with a finger up?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, or a little finger in his on the side of his corner of his mouth, perhaps. But you know, he is a very secretive character, and to be attracting the attention to the club that he is, with the box office of Roy Keane, is an interesting tactic if he does want to remain under the radar, because now the Fourth Estate will be, rather than digging into the £175 billion of debt in this country, will now be trying to find pictures of Marcus Evans.
He's an arms dealer, and when arms are shipped out to, foreign countries, they're often described or on the invoice as agricultural machinery. So it's fitting he's in charge of the tractor boys. But people today have been describing, Roy Keane's dramatic return or sensational return. Yep. It's just a return. It's not dramatic. They're a club. They need a manager. He's an out-of-work manager.
You've got so much to learn as a newspaper journalist. Really, you do.
It might sound a bit silly to say this, but this could be make or break for Keane's managerial career. I mean, he had 100 games at Sunderland. I think won 42, lost 41. Got them up, but didn't, spent badly.
Got them up, he said dismissively. They were in a terrible position in championship terms. He did brilliantly.
But he had the money, it was £35 million that helped them.
Of the championship. Let's not be very clear about that. They were bottom of the championship when he took them over, and he kept them up in the Premier League.
The jury is still out on his managerial acumen, and certainly how he deals with players. I mean, you remember
that's a sensational, dramatic comment from Sean Ingle.
You remember him at Memory TV when he said about Rio Ferdinand. Just because you play, you were paid 120 grand a week and you play well for 20 minutes against Spurs, you think you're a superstar. He reminds me a little bit his managerial style of Tony Adams. Now, great player, wonderful, wonderful leader of men, rubbish manager. Now, I think Keane.
Apart from the fact when he did really, really well in the championship.
Adams did well for a few games at
Wickham. But we're not talking about a few games. You have to accept that Roy Keane did really well.
He had a lot of money, and he had some good players. Lots of managers have had a good 6 months. I think the jury is really out.
He bought very, very well. I mean, Kenwyn Jones, who is at Sunderland still and leads their line, is somebody that Arsene Wenger described as a colossus. And as I'll declare an interest, as a gooner, I'd be quite happy to see him replace Adebayor if the guy leaves.
£5 million for Michael Chopra, £9 million for Craig Gordon, Stanislav Vargas. I mean, I think he bought some good players, but I thought there was a lot of rubbish in there as well.
Yeah, he bought an awful lot of
players. Lots of managers buy bad players, including
Dimitar
Sir Alex
Berbatov.
Ferguson.
Mm.
Yeah. But Keane, I think, is very much a Marmite figure, particularly in Ireland. You're either with him or against him. There seems to be no middle ground. And today on the Sky Sports News, that seemed to be the prevailing attitude among Ipswich fans as well. That
there's no pleasing Suffolk.
I got that joke. But, I did get that joke. So
that's Matt getting the first joke and laughing. He'll get that one in about 10 minutes' time. Brilliant. But, I mean, whether you like him or not, it's interesting times ahead for Ipswich Town fans. God, you're really pleased with yourself, aren't you?
Sorry, Barry, what were you saying?
I said it was exciting times ahead for Ipswich.
Indeed so. Oh, a lovely little post from Gone Postal. At the bottom of Louise's piece, not on our posting boards, check out Brian Clough's biography where Keane's landlady calls Clough, this is just after he signed for Nottingham Forest, and asked him to come round to the digs because she was concerned about the young man. Clough duly turned up and the landlady took Clough to Keane's room. He'd painted the walls and ceiling black. Well, there you go. So Ipswich, interesting times ahead, but I think good news, no?
Good news for journalists, definitely.
Yeah, that's for sure. We're excited about that. Now, we should move on to the midweek games, which saw Man United win 2-0 over Portsmouth. That's their third clean sheet in a row, which is big news because they were... Yeah. Chelsea drew in a game that they're calling the dress rehearsal for the FA Cup with Everton. So looking forward to the FA Cup final now. Oh, yes. And Arsenal went to Liverpool and produced a 4-4 draw that viewers everywhere from Croydon to Kashambu watched in delirious ecstasy, etc. Fantastic stuff.
No, it's a fantastic game. We had this argument on the pod, or I wasn't, but certainly others did, about what constitutes a great game of football. And there are some Puritans out there that love to see 0-0s and 1-0s. But for me, give me, slapdash defending. Give me, wonderful goals. Give me, give me excitement like we had on Tuesday night.
Because I often wonder what happens, somebody say like Jonathan Wilson, our resident tactical expert, when he watches a game like that. I mean, I suspect he's probably absolutely appalled because...
Has anyone heard from Jonathan lately? Yeah. I think we ought to be a bit he's worried about
him off the ceiling.
He must find it so offensive, because it doesn't fit in with... you know, himself and say Paul Doyle, they have great chats about 4-3-1-2, 4-1-3-2, 4-3-3, you know, all this stuff, formation stuff, which I have to say I find incredibly dull and tedious. But when two sort of supposed egghead managers and master tacticians like Benitez and Wenger just their teams forget all the principles of defending, ball control, whatnot, and just throw the kitchen sink at each other. It's great entertainment. Absolutely terrible football. But to describe it as the game of the season or anything is a bit odd. Because
I think you're being very harsh. It's terrible football when Cesc Fabregas plays that pinpoint pass back from the byline for Arshavin to finish as he did. And Arshavin's finish for the left-footed finish with no backlift. The one across Pepe Reina. You know, that's a good goalkeeper that he's beaten four times with four touches. I mean, I think, you know, that is what football's about. I mean, football, condensed football down to the moments like that, and suddenly you've got eight good moments, and I think it's great. We do sit through an awful lot of tedious 0-0 draws between Chelsea and Everton the second.
Sorry, I wasn't suggesting for a moment that it's a bad thing. I wish more games were like that, but there are games like that in, you know, in the lower divisions every week, and we don't give them much attention.
I mean, there are two worrying things for Arsenal. I mean, obviously they're defending, you know, with Gallus out for the season, Silvestre, who was probably shot about 3-4 years ago, being the fulcrum, absolutely terrible. Gibbs, raw, I think, as well. And obviously they're not going to have Arshavin for the Champions League against United as well. You wonder.
It does seem willful that Arsenal not using him in the cup last weekend.
Well, there was concerns over the Wembley pitch, but I think you've got to play someone like Arshavin.
Well, I've got a theory about that. I was there sitting behind enemy lines above the Chelsea fans. Oof. And you could see from the defensive set pieces why Wenger played the players he did. I mean, despite the fact that Abu Diaby and Robin Van Persie were both utter toilet on the day, the reason he played them was because he was worried about, for me, he was worried about Michael Ballack, Drogba, Essien, Alex, you know, Ivanovic, big men at the set pieces. And Arshavin actually sort of touched on that again last night when he talked about, you know, we are worried about defensive corners. The reason why Arshavin and Nasri were left on the bench at the start of that game and he favoured Van Persie was because, and Abu Diaby, was because they needed that height, and it did backfire.
Very interesting. Just on the subject of Liverpool then, who also contributed 50% of the goals, and a fantastic performance in terms of courage and flair and stuff. What has changed there? Because, you know, everyone's pointing out acting without words, says they've scored four goals against Real Madrid, Man United, Chelsea, Arsenal, Aston Villa and Blackburn. This Benitez knows how to entertain, but does he know the first thing about defensive solidity?
Well, I think the big difference is the way they were set up. You know, when they were leading the league, they were being defensive. They were trying not to lose games. Now they've been chasing, from the United game onwards, they've been chasing in the various competitions. Therefore, you set up differently. You, instead of sticking two defensive midfielders, you know, you tell your players to go forward more, and it means more goals, but also more mistakes in defence.
Well, you also can't legislate for Mascherano, somebody who's got great tactical discipline, dwelling on the ball too much. I mean, that's you know.
Right, but in terms of the way it's turned around, it's not to do with the resolved power struggle and Benitez signing a new deal. It's the fact that he's finally realised, oh, I better go for this one.
Having spoken to some people around the training ground at Liverpool this week, there is an intense frustration among the Liverpool players about his minutiae attempt to control every single outcome on the pitch. I mean, the blow up argument about the Liverpool versus Blackburn game and those gesticulations of Benitez is actually born of his complete paranoia, if you like, about his players' independence. He must control everything, even down to the free kicks, and that is really annoying those players. That, you know, that, I can't see that they will have been overly pleased about him remaining there for 5 years, because, I mean, if you see it in Torres, when he scored on Tuesday night, there was the most joyless celebration I've ever seen in my life. You know, he just puts, this is a player who used to run the length of the pitch and screaming and shouting at scoring a goal, and there he was just flinging his arms in the air and not being particularly happy about it.
At some point, you have to trust your players.
Exactly.
And he doesn't.
No.
Whereas Sir Alex Ferguson does. And I think also Benitez's criminal underuse of Yossi Benayoun this season has been indicative of just his shortcomings as a manager. Any time Benayoun has played, he's been top class, and yet he rarely gets a run out.
Does that mean that the title race is now over, or can you see Arsenal doing the same damage or more to Man United?
Well, Arsenal, I think the second last game of the season, I think United should
be done and dusted by then.
All right, well, we'll see. Because
you have a little hunch that Tottenham are going to do a job at Manchester United.
Just the way I'm sitting, actually.
Oh, sorry.
No, yes, I do feel that that might happen. And let's talk about that in part three. Just a quick nod to the fact that if you do want to keep up to date on all the latest stories and comment and a top postal reaction to everything in the world of football, guardian.co.uk/football is the place to do it. Now, part two kicks off with a salute to AZ Alkmaar, champions, as you surely know, of the Dutch Eredivisie, as it's not pronounced. Joining us on the line, Leander Scherlakens, Guardian's top man for all things, Netherlands. How are you, Leander?
I'm very well, James. How are you?
Very, very well. Right, tell us all about this exciting triumph for Louis van Gaal.
Well, it was the first time someone not called Ajax, PSV or Feyenoord won the Eredivisie in 28 years, when AZ won it in 1981. They actually came very close to blowing it once again the way they did 2 years ago, when on their game on Saturday they lost to Vitesse at home, when all they needed for the title was a win. Luckily, Ajax got thumped 6-2 by PSV and AZ were champions.
Leander, I'm interested in Louis van Gaal, who's one of the most sort of credible figures in the sort of last 20 years of football management. He's had these extreme highs with the great Barcelona team in the mid-90s. He's had some plunging lows as well. Can you see him moving to perhaps a bigger club again? Has his stock risen enough? We're winning a sort of joke league in Middle Europe.
Well, Van Gaal has actually been very obnoxious about this win, which was actually the first trophy he won since 1999, when he won the La Liga title with Barcelona, and he's going around saying what a good job he's done, when really the club was built by the chairman, Dirk Scheringa, who put in the money and put in the system that allowed them to win this. But he's actually being linked with going back to Ajax, where the former chairman, Michael van Praag, who is still very powerful there, has said that that Van Gaal is the only real man to be in charge there, because Marco van Basten, as you've probably heard, is not doing so well. Van Gaal himself has said that he'd like to go to either another European Championship or World Cup, and that the only club he would be happy to go to is a real top club like Real Madrid or Barcelona, and that he's going to do one more year at AZ and then retire.
Oh, okay. Van Basten, you mentioned there, losing 6-2 to PSV. The battle for second place, very much the ball in a Twente's court there. They were, 11 points behind AZ? How many points are they clear of Ajax at the moment?
I think they're still clear 1 point, and Ajax, of course, had a chance because AZ kind of unfortunately lost to Feyenoord this weekend 1-0 due to a somewhat dubious penalty and in a very acrimonious environment. And so Ajax had every chance of taking second place from them had they not lost so badly to PSV. Twente is now 1 point ahead of Ajax with 65 points. And 11 points behind AZ with 3 games to go, which, of course, as we know, makes AZ champions. It is still very much in their court. And actually, yesterday, they made it into... No, it was on Tuesday, actually. They made it into the cup final as well.
Oh, good one. So, Steve McLaren, who... Did I see a quote from Johan Cruyff saying that everybody should be playing like McLaren's FC Twente? They are the true heirs of the Dutch football tradition, the total football business.
Yeah, he especially was criticizing the big three there, being Ajax, PSV and Feyenoord, who are not really the big three anymore, saying they should take a good, long, hard look in the mirror and sort of refine their identity. But he has been doing a very good job, and if they hold on to second place, it'll equal the club record of a second place, which they only ever got another time in 1973-1974.
Wow. Well, we've always been big fans here in the pod, so not a surprise for us. Leander, we had a post ages ago from somebody wanting to know why so many teams in Holland use names from Greek mythology. Can you answer that for us?
To be honest, I didn't know the answer, so I went and asked Simon Cooper, and he managed to tell me. Many clubs were founded in the early 1900s by public schoolboys, and as they were studying Greek and Greek mythology, they started naming their clubs after these myths. Classic example, of course, being Ajax, which was originally founded in 1894 and then folded and then was refounded in 1900. And that must have served as some sort of example for all the other public school boys starting their clubs. So football in Holland was actually an upper class sport became, before it became a working class sport.
And obviously the Greek god of electronics, PSV, famously.
Well, it's better than having public schoolboys name their team FC Soggy Biscuit or something.
Indeed. Are these English?
bit of muscular Christianity there.
Are these English public schoolboys, Leander?
Well, they were in the Dutch equivalent of public schools, which is called gymnasium. Which you have four or five or six branches of high school in Holland, depending on how smart you are and basically what sort of upbringing you've had.
Okay.
And that's the translates to the highest one.
Is there any English club that's named after a
Corinthians?
There you go.
Corinthian
Cavaliers. Well, that's not really a
Bly Spartans.
Oh, I suppose Bly Spartans. Good shout. In Italy, you have Atalanta, who are named after the Greek goddess who ran very fast. But that was a Greek teacher at a local school. He wasn't Greek. He taught Greek. Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Well, Leander, that's terrific stuff. So there's a bit of a battle for second place and possibly Steve McLaren romping into the Champions League, which will be entertaining. He did so well last time. Leander, thank you very much for filling us in on all of that. And
thank
look
you.
Forward to speaking to you soon.
I hope so.
Cheers, then.
Bye, James.
Bye. I tell you what, on a European continental tip, how about I just throw some interesting Italian stories at you now? Sean, would you like that?
I can't wait.
Well, I tell you what, you're all poo-pooing.
No, I'm not, because I'm interested, because Carlo Ancelotti is apparently learning English. Did he
is
know?
He? Well, he's learned a lot of things. He's learned how to fly a helicopter. Yeah. Anyway, but I wasn't going to talk about him. I was going to talk about Juventus, where your old pal Claudio Ranieri. Have I used that line about its outlook, Claudio? Because it certainly is right now. There's all sorts of trouble kicking off there. They got knocked out of the Champions League. They had the big derby of Italy with Inter at the weekend, where they were supposed to cut down Inter's lead, and instead it was a 1-1 draw in Turin. And last night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, they got knocked out of the Coppa Italia semi-finals. Lazio beat them 2-1 in Turin, after which fans were so irate that, having chanted Ranieri out and various other variations on that during the game, they then besieged the locker room, and the riot police had to be called out to ensure the safe exit of the Juve squad. They're very, very unhappy about him. But to be honest about Ranieri and some of his choices, for example, leaving Del Piero, Camoranesi and Nedved on the bench, even though they were 2-1 down from the first leg in Rome. But beyond that, it goes back, I think, this to problems from last week. We mentioned the idea that it seems to be more or less unofficially confirmed this, that Cannavaro might be returning to the team. But also, one of the directors of the club was seen having dinner with Marcello Lippi. And the story is now that apparently Marcello Lippi, after taking Italy, he hopes, to the World Cup in 2010, will then be retaking the reins for the third time at Juventus. And the fans are not happy about this at all. A lot of these people they regard as traitors, particularly Cannavaro, was being denounced in the chants yesterday as a traitor for leaving the club when he did, when some of the players like Del Piero stuck around when they got sent down to the second division. And the idea previously that Antonio Conte, who is regarded as a true servant of Juventus in his time, who's now got Bari in line for promotion down in Serie B, he was going to be taking over. So there's all sorts of unrest and things looking very nasty up there. Big split between the fans and the directors as Juve, who basically haven't, I think they've barely won a game since they went out of the Champions League, really hit towards a very anticlimactic end to the season.
Having a go at Cannavaro for leaving Juve to Real Madrid is just nonsense. I mean, the guy got towards the end of his career, and frankly, he was doing a perfectly reasonable thing to cash in on Italy's World Cup success. In Italy, defenders, as you know, James, very well, don't get paid well. You know, Paolo Maldini gets nowhere near what Kaká does, despite his longevity of service and the number of medals that he's won at Milan.
Right. No, it's an absolutely fair point. One thing about Cannavaro is I think that he and Zambrotta, who also left, Zambrotta went to Barcelona, Zambrotta certainly expressed the feeling that if anyone was betrayed, it was the players by the club, because
Indeed.
They felt they'd won two titles, which
Indeed.
They then found taken away from them because of the activities of someone up in the boardroom. I personally wouldn't be that surprised if that somebody up in the boardroom was somehow behind a lot of this unrest among the Juve fans, who've never bought the line that Moggi really was the only bad guy. They feel that they've been they find it easier to go with the idea that they've been unfairly singled out, etc. And so there's always been that disposition, if you will, to not go with the new management. The weekend, Juventus are at the bottom side, Regina. Fiorentina host Roma. There's just 3 points between them in the battle to then challenge Genoa for the fourth Champions League place. And I mentioned at the start, Mick and Muck. Roma, we mentioned before, they are 300 million euros in debt to one of the big Italian banks. And apparently, Mick and Muck Flick, who, well, their real names are Gert and Friedrich, but that's not quite as interesting. That's what they're called in Germany. They are coming in to buy 50% of the club. That's the story, so we'll bring you up to date on that.
You were certainly right when you said it wouldn't be as interesting a story as your introduction suggested.
Yeah, there we go.
To be honest, Jim, I'm amazed you're so cheery after yesterday's budget. You were clobbing him, then Barry as well. Poor Barry, the 16p on spirits.
Yeah.
I don't go near the top shelf.
Right.
Nah.
Okay.
Only in the news agents.
Beer, the occasional cider.
I tell you what, for the economically minded out there, what are you referring to, Sean?
The 50% tax rise on earnings over 150k
a
year.
All right, well, there you go.
Which, actually, as a serious point, since this is Football Weekly Extra, it's going to be a real problem for English Premier League clubs.
It's an interesting point, Matt.
Every data player who comes to England always deals in netto, and they want to be paid irrespective of their gross issues and the tax and the currency fluctuations. They want to receive their money net, and this is going to have to be the clubs will have to find an extra 20% as a result of this to fund their wage.
Very interesting.
Bills.
This is going to bring indeed English football in line with, say, French and Italian football, whereas the Spanish have this bizarre rule where if you're a professional from abroad, you actually get tax exemptions for how many? Is it 3 years?
Yeah, and there is a very, very low tax rate even after that.
Yeah. Crazy. That's very, very fine point. Thanks, Matt. I tell you what, actually,
you sounded so smashing, nice and insincere when you said that.
I meant it. Now, posts. Let's look at some posts. If you're not posting, you're missing half the fun. I post all the time using a variety of assumed names. Marsman, Marcella Proust, those are some of them. Barry, you were particularly good, I thought, on the post this week, Barry.
Was I?
Yeah, you were. Go on, you know it. Wonk. Is it a truism that however much you loathe the team, there's always one member of it you don't heap the same level of opprobrium on? At Man United, he cites Paul Scholes, Essien at Chelsea, Alonso at Liverpool. Not sure about your examples, but I think that's true. I mean, 11 players, there's always going to be one you're not that bothered about.
Life's too short for hating, isn't it, Jimbo?
Yeah. It's so easy to laugh, it's so easy to hate. It takes strength to be gentle and kind.
I find it, I'm struggling to think of any Chelsea player I'd like to go for a few pints with. Loud silence.
Essien's all right.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
Peter
Cech. So quiet, though.
I'm going for a drink with Peter Cech.
Peter Cech, he's a nice fella.
He's a nice fella.
Isn't Joe Cole all right? Jesse Playmore. There was a kid at my junior school who wore a Hamburg shirt to football practice. When I asked if he supported them, he confidently stated, "I support every team in the world," which was either mighty smart or just plain cheating. I like that. Zinedine Fleming. Well done to Barry for shoehorning in a mention of the exciting race for the title in the country's worst professional league, the Blue Square Premier. Burton were actually 21 points ahead of my team, Cambridge, in January, but thanks to them doing their best Devon Lock impression, the gap could be zero after the final games on Sunday. I'm surprised Jimbo isn't aware of this, etc., Satanta, blah, blah, blah. Francis Lardas. I've been sorely disappointed to hear thus far no mention of Altrincham's miraculous escape from relegation from the Blue Square Premier. The escape was messianic, because it involved winning games and piling on the points, which you might think is normal, but not for them, apparently, because in each of the three previous seasons, they've avoided relegation by default, as enough clubs in the division were either deducted mountains of points for financial wrongdoing or simply ran out of juice and were wound up. So all they had to do was turn up. Matt?
More esoteric lower division or non-league knowledge. Billericay Town, who are from Essex, as the people who know local geography will be aware,
get on with
risk playing in the Blue Square North next season, depending on the outcomes of promotion and relegation, which will be cripplingly expensive for them when they have to go up to possibly Gateshead if they don't get promoted out of that league.
Why?
Because they are the northernmost team in the Blue Square South at the moment. And the reason for that is the organic process. Because of the two feeder leagues for the Blue Square system, the Unibond and Ryman are in the south, and only one from the north being... the Unibond is from the north,
what,
and Ryman and the other. It's, yeah, organic right. process. Loads right. of southern clubs, all to do with demographics, and those poor beggars from Billericay could have to go all the way up to Stadium Celtic.
That's it for part two. Stick around, as in a second or two, Sib will be talking to us about that extraordinary Getafe Real Madrid game from midweek. Sid, thank you for joining us. Let's talk about Getafe Real Madrid. One of the games of the season, one of the worst penalties of the season, one of the worst fouls of all time.
It was mental. It was really, really good fun. I was lucky enough as well to be watching it from the north stand at the Santiago Bernabeu, and that was the end where all the madness happened. So I had a fantastically good view of Pepe kicking out to Javier Casquero. I saw a fantastic view of, as you say, possibly the worst penalty of all time. I have to admit, I still haven't seen the infamous Berbatov penalty, but from what I've been told, I think Casquero's was even worse. Imagine the picture the scene. It's 2-2. There's 2 minutes to go. Getafe are in relegation trouble, so it's not like this doesn't matter. They've got the chance to beat Real Madrid 3-2 at the Santiago Bernabeu. The guy that's going to take it can kick a ball like a mule. He really thumps the ball really, really hard.
Well, first off, the way the penalty is given, I mean, it's extraordinary decision by Pepe. What was he thinking of?
Well, okay, yeah, let's go back even further. Yeah, so you've got Casquero running through and Pepe just basically runs up behind him and pushes him over. It was quite bizarre. I have to say, I think that Casquero slowed down to wait for the challenge.
Yeah, but he didn't just push him over. He then raked his studs up his back.
Oh, no, yeah, absolutely. But that obviously wasn't what gave the penalty, but that is what might lead to a big, big ban. He pushes him over. When he's on the floor, he kicks him in the back. He then trod on his ankle very deliberately, a bit of a kind of a pushing and shoving start. So then he punches someone full in the face. So then you get the penalty once Pepe is finally taken off the pitch. And on his way off the pitch, he calls the fourth line, calls over the fourth linesman and says, "You're all a bunch of sons of you-know-what." And so basically, eventually it calms down to you. It's the 82nd minute. You've got Casquero about to take a penalty. As I say, a guy who can thump the ball brilliantly. 2 minutes to go, chance to beat Real Madrid, chance to save Getafe because they're in relegation trouble still. And so he tries to do what's known in England, obviously, as a Dwight York, but what's known always in Spain as a Panenka after the guy who did it in 76 European Championships, I think, and just dinks it right into Casillas' arms. The penalty's so bad, you know, that Casillas had time to go the wrong way and get back up and catch it.
My word. My word. And then Real Madrid swarmed down the other end and scored their own 3-2.
Scored an incredible goal, yeah. Gonzalo Higuain battered one in from the edge of the area. The whole place went absolutely bonkers. This is a 93rd minute. Suddenly Real Madrid think they're back in it. They got out of jail. They survived again. It reminds everybody of what happened a couple of years ago when they won the league in the most ludicrously implausible circumstances you could ever imagine. So, of course, Casquero is kicking himself, although obviously not very hard. Pepe, when Real Madrid scored a winner, runs on the pitch and jumps into the bundle of celebrations. Now, of course, he's been sent off. He shouldn't be anywhere near the bench, let alone running onto the pitch. So that might well count against him as well. And it was all a bit mad, really.
That was revolting what he did. He says, "These are the worst days of my life. I do not have any desire to return to playing football." But what on earth put him in that state? Is there something going on with Pepe that wound him up like that?
Well, I think it's worth kind of almost doing a profile of Pepe. And I'm always very reluctant to play a kind of amateur psychologist, but let's try. On the pitch, Pepe has always been extremely volatile. In the first couple of pre-season games, in fact, you know what? I've got a feeling it might even have been the game against Stoke that they played in a random village in the middle of the Alps somewhere, I think. And he nutted someone. I might be wrong about the opponents, but it was a pre-season game, pretty much at the very start of his Real Madrid career. I remember at the start of Real Madrid's career, for him, 3 or 4 games in, saying that this is a guy that's just a red card waiting to happen in every single game because he's screams into tackles, he pushes people, he fouls, he's nasty, he's aggressive. But actually, he'd settled a bit, and he's a very, very good player, by the way. But oddly, off the pitch, and I know this sounds like a cop-out, and it sounds too easy to say this, off the pitch, he's genuinely nice. He's probably one of the, in fact, I'd say definitely one of the nicer guys in the Real Madrid squad. So it is very strange. So I can understand his remorse now, because I think he probably looks at it and doesn't recognise himself. But it is true that on the pitch, he has done things maybe not as bad as this, but pretty bad things all the time. What Juan de Ramos said as well, which I thought was very interesting, he said after the game, "You have to remember the situation. Pepe thinks that he's just given away the penalty that's basically meant that Real Madrid will no longer win the league because they would have been 6 points behind Barcelona. Barcelona have a game in hand. They've blown it. It's all over. He thinks he's screwed everything up."
So he punches someone in the face.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying it's justified, but we're trying to get inside his head, trying to work out what it is that's going through his mind. So he thinks that he's blown it after 16 matches in which they've won 15. They've been really fighting, fighting to be in the title race. He thinks he screwed it up. And I think that tells you, by the way, something about the psychological pressure that Madrid are suffering. Everyone's talking about Barcelona suffering the pressure of Madrid pursuing them. I think Real Madrid are suffering enormous pressure for keeping on winning and then looking around and thinking, bloody hell, Barcelona just won't lose no matter what we do. So Pepe's in a situation where he thinks he's blown it for everybody. And he completely loses his rag. Now, as I say, he's emotional on the pitch anyway. He's aggressive on the pitch anyway. This by no means justifies it. But I think it's important to try and explain what might be going through his mind at the time.
Mm. Now, Barcelona are facing Valencia this weekend, which is potentially a difficult game. Who have Real Madrid got?
Real Madrid go away to Sevilla. And what's really interesting about this is that last night Barcelona played Sevilla at the Camp Nou. Of course, this was going to be the difficult game that, that Real Madrid fans were clinging to, or one of the difficult games that Madrid fans were clinging to. This is brilliant. You know, we managed to get this amazing 3-2. And now Barcelona have to play Sevilla, and oh, that's not going to be easy. There's no way they're going to beat Sevilla, and it really could be down to 3 points or 4 points. You know, maybe Barcelona will draw. And Barcelona last night absolutely clobbered Sevilla 4-0. They really did dominate from start to finish. Andres Iniesta in particular was fantastic. But there is a caveat to that, and that is the fact that Sevilla started without Canute and without Dusha. There seems possibly to have been a sense that the coach Manuel Jimenez decided, well, we can't beat Barcelona. Tell you what, let's rest a couple of players and make sure we do beat Real Madrid.
Sit or Simon, in fact. Thank you very much for that. Entertaining as ever. And we'll catch up with you on Monday if we may.
Yep, that'll be good.
Nice one. Have a
Cheers.
Nice weekend.
Bye-bye.
Now, speaking of weekends, let's have a look, shall we, at what's coming up in the Premier League. Saturday, you've got Bolton, Aston Villa, Everton, Man City, Fulham, Stoke, who pretty much safe by now, aren't they? Stoke, Fulham in that race for a possible Europa League place. Hull, meanwhile, are hosting Liverpool. And could this get Hull into severe trouble? Is there any way they can cause Liverpool problems?
They're in severe trouble already, Jimbo. And they've got a really tough
run. They're 4 points clear still.
Yeah, they've got a really tough run. And they've got Liverpool, Man United and Arsenal.
Yeah, but you do need Newcastle to put pressure on them. And they are showing absolutely no sign of doing that at the moment.
Right, OK. So you fancy Liverpool to just happily sail through that trip to the KC?
I mean, it's not reinventing anything.
All right, then. You mentioned Newcastle. And they play on Monday. They are at home to Portsmouth. This is one of the famous three games that blah, blah, blah. This is where they're going to get their points. Is it going to happen, Matt?
Potentially. I mean, they've just got to get this. The rocket scientist that is Ian Dowie and Alan Shearer, a man of huge experience in Premier League football, go out against Tottenham last weekend. A team that we know are going to play one up top with Robbie Keane doing whatever the hell he wants all over the place, and decide to have three centre-backs. Compounding also that problem is the fact that Aaron Lennon is quite quick and can get down the flank, and you're not putting him back with a left-winger. And having said already that sort of thing bores me, those kind of 4-2-3-1 conversations bore me, but that one is just such a no-brainer.
Well, the crucial thing here, because I had to have this explained to me, is the fact that when you have three centre-backs, you only have one guy covering each wing, as opposed to having
right.
two. And so if you have a speedy
exactly
chap like Lennon,
precisely.
They're going to get caught
and you've
out.
Got and you've got three centre halves marking a single man.
Yeah,
what utter nonsense. I mean, the best way to stop somebody who is as fast as Lennon is arguably to get forward and have a fullback who raids down the flank. Suddenly things change. Yeah, having threatened to let in three goals in the first half, things were changed around, and suddenly they got back into the game, but it was far too late. I think it's a complete nonsense to be talking about Michael Owen and how he's not getting the he's not on the form. The point is about the defensive
right.
frailties.
Well, they've slipped to 4 points now off safety. That game coming up on Monday, by the way.
What I can't understand is if people like us know that. Why don't people like Ian Dowie and Alan Shearer know that?
Maybe they listen to the podcast. Ian and Alan.
Well, Shearer's wedded to that 3-5-2 formation from his England time. I
mean, does he have the personnel to play otherwise?
Yeah, of course he does.
All right.
Of course
just
he
asking.
Does.
He's been just playing 4-4-2 for donkey's years.
Right, good. Now, elsewhere, Man United play Tottenham now. Ah, Barry.
Well,
when was the last time Tottenham won at Old Trafford?
1980-something?
89?
Yeah,
okay. I'm not saying they're going to win, Spurs, but it just seems like the kind of thing they do. They're on a real roll. Harry Redknapp. Did you know they only had 2 points in 8 games when he arrived?
Yes.
Yes, of course you did. And they're on a real roll. And United, John O'Shea and Gary Neville are both out injured for whatever that's worth.
Some would say that's
bonus.
Much, yeah, a bit of a bonus.
But I just have a funny feeling that United are not firing on all cylinders, and Spurs, who are a team with a certain amount of momentum about them, might go there and just get and nick a draw.
Well, you can have 8-1 on the win,
can
or 7-2 on the draw if
you're very kind. Interesting.
Man, you did appear to be firing on most cylinders last night, just their cylinders up front weren't as
well. Those are crucial
well-oiled
cylinders. Arsenal, meanwhile, are hosting Middlesbrough on Sunday. And you don't fancy Borough's chances, even though they did once beat Liverpool.
They're a chameleonic side of that.
Yeah,
a word.
Not that chameleon.
Wild and whilst, those are words. Chameleonic, nah.
All right. Well, just lastly then, West Ham-Chelsea on Saturday afternoon. Matt, you had a very interesting piece last Saturday about how the long-feared semi-administration of West Ham was now only months away, and that basically the banks were going to be reappropriating the club from, what's his name, Goodmanson? And or Gudjonsson,
Bjørgulfur Gudmundsson.
Oh, there you go. And as a result, the club would be basically just ticking over and not investing any money in that. And I was just really surprised. This is major news, and nobody's picked up on it at all since.
Yeah, it was last Friday actually. So if you want to go finding that, readers, just check on the Guardian.co.uk archive.
Right, okay. But it's still up there. Lawyers haven't taken it away or anything.
No. I mean, the fact is, look, that Straumer is the biggest lender into Hansa, which is the holding company for West Ham United. That Goodmanson used as his investment vehicle, and they've effectively taken control of the club. They did so they've been doing it for 2 or 3 months now, since Hansa's position became ever more in the quicksand. But the interesting thing is that Straumer itself was declared insolvent by the Financial Services Authority only last month. So what they're trying to do is unwind their toxic assets, and you might consider that a football club might be on the noxious side of businesses, and potentially if they fall out of the Premier League, as they have done within recent years anyway, West Ham. I think it's an interesting situation. They claim that they are an asset management company now, that all the old rules about operating assets will change, that you know, banks normally lend money and let you get on with it, but now they're actually taking control completely. My instinct is that that's just a negotiating tactic, and if you were to say West Ham is for sale, it would be rather less valuable than if you say we are long-term investors and want to hang on to this asset for a long time. Right. So that's my instinct, is that things are still pretty unstable. I don't see the status quo remaining beyond the next 12-18 months.
All right. Will Zola have any money to spend this summer?
He will have what he raises at best.
Right. Okay. Very interesting. I think that's it for another whirlwind romp through the world of football. Many thanks for powering it along, Mr. Matt Scott, Mr. Barry Glendenning, and Mr. Sean Ingle, and producer Pete there. Nice one. Thanks for joining us, listeners. We're back on Monday. Hopefully you will be too.